It's Wednesday, November 10, 2010. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. President Barack Obama was in Jakarta, Indonesia on Tuesday, speaking to a group of about 6,500 students at the University of Indonesia. The White House has been presenting this speech as a major outreach to the Muslim community, and that makes sense, because Indonesia is, after all, the largest Muslim nation in the world. That is the nation with the largest Muslim population. The president lauded Indonesia for its diversity and its tolerance. He spoke of the fact that its Muslim culture was not there incompatible with a sense of national diversity. White House officials pointed to this speech because even as President Obama a year ago spoke in Cairo in an effort to reach out to the Muslim community, the White House and international sources have felt that the Obama administration had been losing ground as he was speaking to the Muslim world. Now, speaking in Indonesia, the president of the United States had a rather unique advantage. He had lived there as a child, spending about 6 years of his childhood living in Indonesia with his mother when she was married to an Indonesian man. He lived indeed in Jakarta. And it was moving to see the President of the United States speak of the unlikelihood of his election, tracing it back to the time when he was a boy in Jakarta. He also spoke in the Indonesian language in a way that clearly thrilled the crowd there in Jakarta. The larger challenge of the speech, of course, was to reach out to the Muslim community. But one of the big questions to be raised in this sense is exactly what message the White House is trying to send. In this speech, it appeared that what the president was trying to do was to point to a lack of incompatibility and conflict between a notion of tolerance in a society, indeed even pluralism in a society on the one hand, and a Muslim majority on the other. This was a speech that was delivered in Jakarta as the president is on his way to Seoul and had been in India. But it might be true that the intended audience for this speech wasn't so much in Jakarta as throughout the Muslim world, especially as many might be in the Arabian Peninsula. There is nothing like Indonesia there, nothing like its rule of law, nothing like its protections of minorities, nothing like its openness. Indonesia is a nation which, after all, is made up of almost countless islands. It is also a nation that has been racked by significant conflict in its past. It is now in a position of considerable stability, and it is now a nation that is visited by the President of the United States, who went there with a message. The President's visit was cut short because of the eruption of a volcano in Indonesia. The President will spend time in Seoul, Korea, before returning to the United States. In recent days, USA Today has had some interesting pieces. One of them is by Ken Paulson. Mr. Paulson is identified on the op-ed page of USA Today as president of the First Amendment Center and a former editor of USA Today and a member of USA Today's board of contributors. This is someone who's an outsider who was once an insider. He's writing about First Amendment protections for obscene and violent video games. There is a pivotal case that is now before the U.S. Supreme Court having to do with whether or not the First Amendment covers virtually any kind of presentation of violence or sexuality, especially violence in this case, that would be presented in terms of a video game. Now, the world of video games is often distant from the lives of many who are familiar with other aspects of the culture. But many people who are not familiar with those games would likely be shocked by the kind of routine violence, almost macabre, absolutely unbelievably treacherous violence, that is the standard fare in those games. Things such as torture, beheadings, a great deal of death and mayhem and loss of blood and dismemberment and all the rest. You know, most parents will look at this and say they don't want their children anywhere near that. Now, Mr. Paulson, writing in USA Today, says that it is not the Supreme Court's role to make the decision as to what should or should not be allowed in video games. Now, that's a very interesting argument. It would be an interesting argument, of course, if it were made by an absolute First Amendment purist, and it looks like that's what Mr. Paulson is. But he seems to concede that the Supreme Court had a role and indeed moved in the right direction in putting some limitations upon sexual material that is legally defined as obscenity. But when it comes to violence, he says there ought to be an absolute pass. I think this is going to be a very interesting argument before the U.S. Supreme Court and a very interesting decision once it hands it down. But parents need to pay heed to this. Because even as there is now an academic debate, indeed now a judicial debate, over what should and shouldn't be allowed, parents are the front line in this issue. And parents have a moral responsibility to know exactly what kinds of games their children are playing, especially in their own home. A quick look at some of the material in these particular games, widely available, now without restriction, should tell us that there is a huge problem here. The second piece in USA Today appeared Monday by Kirsten Powers. The title of it on the op-ed piece certainly captures the attention, Hypocrisy and Gay Marriage. Now, one of the interesting things about this author, Kirsten Powers, is that she's identified as a freelance writer and political analyst on Fox News. She also worked in the Clinton administration from 1993 to 1998 and has worked in politics in New York State and in the city of New York. Now, she makes a very, very straightforward argument in this article. She argues that opposition to same-sex marriage amounts to hypocrisy. Now, she also makes a parallel argument that all opposition to same-sex marriage represents homophobia and intolerance and discrimination. This is not a smart article. It's really not. This is not an intelligent argument, but she gets away with it in an op-ed piece because many of these pieces appear in the nation's newspapers, not because of the cogency and persuasiveness of their argument, but because of the relative emotional impact and value that an editor sees when he places an article like this in the queue to be published. Now, one of the arguments Ms. Power makes here is that those who are pressing to keep marriage as defined as the union of a man and a woman, thereby to cease and prevent the recognition of same-sex marriage, that they are driven by an effort to establish a theocracy. Now, she goes on to correct us by saying that the governing document of the United States is not the Bible, but the Constitution. Now, that's one of those very seemingly clever arguments that gets some traction out there in the public square. And of course, we do not live in a theocracy. Christians ought to be the first to recognize that our governing document for this nation is indeed the Constitution. We live by the rule of law in a constitutionally governed democratic republic. We understand that. But the argument here is that any effort to limit sexual behavior and to establish any normality for sexual relationships is indeed tantamount to establishing a theocracy. Now, here's why that is a really unintelligent argument. It's because everyone, I'm sure even in this case Ms. Powers, actually argues that some sexual behaviors ought not to be recognized and respected, and that some sexual relationships are not to be recognized and normalized. So the question is, who draws the line and where? One of the interesting weapons of, you might say, cultural warfare in this particular debate is the fact that people throw out that those who want to limit any kind of sexual expression and fail to normalize any sexual relationship are somehow trying to enforce and establish a theocracy. That needs to be turned on those who are making the argument. Where do you draw the line? How do you draw the line? How do you justify that line? And how is it that you, evidently, feel yourself not to be establishing a theocracy when you are also arbitrarily drawing a line at certain sexual behaviors and certain sexual relationships? Now, she makes the other point in here that evangelicals are caught in a bind because of our high divorce rate. We're doing more damage, she suggests, to marriage than the proponents of same-sex marriage. We need to meet that argument as well with the admission that we have seriously failed marriage. But our failure of marriage as a people, and there are all kinds of reasons behind this in terms of the high divorce rate, and there are many of us who for many years have been decrying this and calling evangelicals to reverse the course and uphold the sanctity of marriage, a failure of a marriage ethic does not justify the destruction of the institution of marriage itself. That's something we have to keep in mind because many of these arguments look powerful on their face. But when you really try to figure out how that argument can be traced back and applied to actual policymaking, it doesn't turn out very well. We hear a great deal these days about limited government, and for good reason. The only government that should exist is one that is severely and constitutionally limited. But when it comes to limited government, Christians need to be reminded that we have a Genesis 3 mandate for limited government because we understand that the larger government gets, the more entangled it becomes in our lives, the more institutional forms of sin have their way, the more dangerous, literally, the government becomes. Sometimes it's not so much seen as dangerous as ludicrous, perhaps even humorous. The front page of Sunday's edition of the New York Times had something that I don't want to let go. It's an article by Michael Moss that has to do with government policies concerning cheese. Now just keep this in mind. It turns out that one part of the federal government is warning that we are eating too much cheese. Our diet is simply far too high in fat. And there's an effort, using our tax monies, a massive effort, to try to limit the cheese intake of American citizens. Meanwhile, on another street, in another part of our federal government, there is an organization known as Dairy Management. That tax-supported part of our government worked with Domino's Pizza to increase, by a significant degree, the amount of cheese on its pizzas. Federal monies in the amount of $12 million were devoted to this marketing campaign. So, thus the headline in the New York Times, "While warning about fat, U.S. pushes cheese sales." While one part of the government is trying to cut back on our intake of cheese, using our tax dollars, another part of the government is using our tax dollars in order to encourage more eating of cheese, throwing $12 million into a marketing campaign for a new quantum cheese pizza. Now, this is not just to decry government. Government has a necessary role as instituted by God, but it needs to be within clearly defined limitations. This kind of ludicrous example of governmental internal competition, waste, and a seeming sense of the lack of a direction is also a sign that what is going on in government is what's going on wherever human beings are found. Where there's a coalescence of power, well, remember Lord Acton's dictum that power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Well, bureaucracies confuse and waste, and absolute bureaucracies absolutely confuse and absolutely waste. Lastly, news came out of Detroit that a winning 9-figure jackpot lottery ticket was bought in an adult bookstore. That led many in the media in Detroit and elsewhere to speculate on whether or not the person, presumably a man, who bought the ticket would admit to his wife that he indeed was the winner because, well, everyone's going to be able to track that winning ticket directly to a pornography store. But most of the secular observation, I think, got to the heart of the matter. For a 9-figure jackpot, most women will perhaps overlook the pornography. You want a sign that we're living in a fallen world? Just consider that juxtaposition. A lottery ticket sold in an adult bookstore. That's the world we're living in. We shouldn't be surprised. We've read the Bible. We know how it works. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmoeller.com. You can follow my daily updates on Twitter at twitter.com/Albert Moeller. For more information about the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu, and for Boyce College, go to boycecollege.com. Many wrote in yesterday to ask to be added to the mailing list for The Briefing. That's the email version of a long list of links that are available every morning, Monday through Friday. Just go to my website at albertmoeller.com and indicate that you'd like to receive that mailing. Remember also that when you look on the website, you'll find a host of materials, including links to the articles discussed in today's edition of The Briefing. I'll meet you tomorrow for The Briefing.